Stars Over Surrey with Dave Gematis and John Extell from the Guildford Astronomical Society. Well, in fact, it's Graham Laycock sitting in for Dave today, and good to meet up with you again, John.
Indeed. Hello, Graham.
Right, we're going to be talking about the world of space flight and astronomy, your constellation of the month, what to look for in the night sky next month, and events at local astronomical societies. But first, John, what's happening in space flight and astronomy?
Okay, well, I think, you know, the big news, the most important news for amateur astronomers and professional astronomers, of course, as well, is that the James Webb Space Telescope has arrived in its correct place and all seems to be going well. It's in a particular part of Earth's orbit called Lagrange Point 2. Lagrange points are places where the Earth's and the Sun's gravitational pull counter the speed that is necessary to maintain a stable orbit. And so that means that a spacecraft at one of these 5 points uses very little fuel for station keeping. So that means you can pack more and more instrumentation on the spacecraft rather than having to fill it with fuel. So in the slides that accompany this little talk is a couple of examples of showing where these Lagrange points are. And Lagrange point 2 is in fact t'other side of the Earth from the Sun. So it's about a million or so miles further out from the Earth. But really good news is that the European Space Agency's rocket, which launched the James Webb Space Telescope, Ariane 5, did it so flawlessly, so accurately, that it saved a huge amount of what otherwise would have been used up in terms of fuel to put it in exactly the right place. So they're talking about it as possibly having extended the lifetime of JWST, perhaps by as many as 5 years, maybe even longer.
That's marvellous news, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And we're expecting so much from this, aren't we?
Oh, incredible results are expected. I mean, to actually, the very last firing to put the spacecraft into the right orbit, which is, about a fortnight ago, it only needed a 4-minute, 57-second burn to put it into the right place. That was just increasing its speed by 3.6 miles an hour.
Absolutely amazing. I wish I could do that in my car.
So it will still need to make tiny little adjustments every 3 weeks, apparently, because it's not that stable a place, but it's stable enough. But it's been a tremendous achievement, as I think I mentioned in the last program to Dave. There are 344 single points of failure, which means that if one of them had gone wrong, that was it.
My goodness, mate. What a success anyway so far.
Yeah. So what's happening now is that it's cooling down. It's already reached minus 347 degrees at the last point, so that I took a note, but the target is minus 390 degrees. This is because, unlike Hubble, which is essentially a visual telescope, this one is working in infrared, and so it needs to be ultra-cool to detect what it's looking for, going back to the first stars in the early days after the Big Bang. And again, something I might have mentioned, it's going to be so accurate that were it looking at a bumblebee on the moon, it would detect it.
Goodness me.
From the Earth, yeah. It's, it's going through, apart from the cooling down, a calibration and testing phase at the moment. There are 18 segments in the mirror that make up the main mirror, 18 separate small mirrors, and each of those has got 7 actuators, 6 of which are to change its position and maybe slightly change its shape. The last report I read, it said that the accuracy was now down to 1 millimetre, but that is far, far too big. What they're aiming for is 1/10,000th the width of a human hair.
Goodness me.
That's the accuracy. So it's going to be absolutely tenterhooks waiting until June or thereabouts when we get our first light and first images. I just don't know what those first images are likely to be, what they're wanting to look at. Okay, let's move on to something a little bit closer. As I say to listeners, do have a look at the slides because there's some explanations about the Lagrange points and where the JWST is orbiting. So something a lot closer to home now. We're all familiar with Virgin Atlantic and their big jumbos, something girl as the name. One of those got converted, it was called Cosmic Girl, by a sister company of Virgin Atlantic. This is Virgin Orbit. And that carries up Virgin Orbit's Launcher 1, which is a 21-metre long kerosene and liquid oxygen fired rocket. It carries that under its wing. The rocket is laden not just with fuel, but with satellites, small satellites. And on the 13th of January, it had its third success in a row of launching satellites. Now, that was taking off from the base of Virgin Orbit, which is in the Mojave Desert, Mojave Air and Spaceport, they call it. But the British involvement with this was that the chap that actually released the rocket from the plane was Flight Lieutenant Matthew Stannard, who ordinarily is a Typhoon fighter pilot in the Royal Air Force. But he is on secondment to Virgin Orbit because the Ministry of Defence has a contract with Virgin Orbit to launch satellites, which will beam in the event of some, you know, conflict or whatever, battlefield information directly from the satellites into the cockpits of RAF fighters. So that's quite an advanced concept. So he's involved heavily in this. So this is part of his familiarisation with the way that Virgin Orbit works. But as part of the publicity about this launch, they've also said that there will be five more such launches this year, and two of them are going to be from Britain, from Spaceport Cornwall, which used to be known as RAF St Morgan, which is down on the north coast of Cornwall. So these will be the first satellite launches, not just from the United Kingdom, but from the whole of Europe. And, of course, it's a very flexible way of launching satellites. You can, even on a land-based launching system, you have to take account of where the boosters might fall and so on, and the trajectories have to take other population centres into account. But if it's air launched from a plane, it just flies out somewhere into the Atlantic, gets into a little racetrack type orbit until it gets the go ahead to launch, and away you go. And it can position its orbit according to the needs of the customer, not just the needs of the geography of the launch base. Okay, so. A little bit further away, and I've mentioned Lagrange points, this comes into effect again. Earth has got a new, we'll call it a companion. Jupiter, the largest planet in our solar system, of course, has, like the Earth, got Lagrange points. As I said, there are five of them, places where the gravity balances itself out. And it was discovered way back in 1906 that, in fact, there were some asteroids occupying Jupiter's Lagrange points, or rather the ones that are known as L4 and L5. These are ones that are about 60 degrees ahead of Jupiter in its orbit and 60 degrees behind. Astronomers like to, in the past, have often named minor planets, asteroids, and so on, after mythical characters. So they kept on the tradition, and the first one was called Achilles, who of course was one of the Greek heroes of the Trojan Wars. But they kept discovering them. So they kept naming them after the heroes of the Trojan Wars. So there's two families. The ones at one of the Lagrange points are all of the Trojan warriors, and the ones at the trailing ones are all of the Greek warriors and so on. So there's about 10,000 of those that have been discovered, but it's thought that there's plenty more smaller ones that we can't see from Earth, probably up to a million or something like that. And in fact, NASA's Lucy mission is en route to study those. Now, the reason I'm mentioning that is just to explain why they're called Trojans. But Earth has now got its own Trojan asteroid, or rather a very, very tiny one, was discovered a few years ago, but now a much more reasonable sized one has been discovered. And this is in orbiting the Sun in our Lagrange 4 point. So that means it's, you know, it's 90-plus million miles away, 93 million miles away.
That's why we've only just discovered it, I presume, isn't it?
It's very difficult for us to observe asteroids at that point because you're looking towards the Sun.
Yes.
And also, of course, they're very, very dark.
Mm.
And difficult to see. So we've seen them reflecting the sunlight back towards us from, you know, Jupiter, Saturn. I think Venus has been discovered to have some. I can't remember, probably Mars as well.
And I'm sure there's more to be discovered.
Absolutely. But this one was first discovered in 2020, but its orbit wasn't really well known. It was just spotted then. But it's taken a team of three different astronomical teams working together in different parts of the world using different instruments to track its orbit down. And it's only just been announced that it is indeed a Trojan asteroid for us. This one's about three-quarters of a mile across. So, not huge, but a bit more substantial than the previous tiny little rock. Now, what's interesting is it's been given the name, or 2020, as part of when it was discovered. That's always part of the name. But the next one is XL5. Nobody seems to have spotted that we used to have a very interesting program called XL5.
Well, it was Fireball
XL5.
Absolutely. Yes, yeah. I remember that.
And not one single person in any of the astronomical press seems to have come up with the idea, maybe we ought to call this little body Fireball. So I'm going to name it Fireball. And, but it's carbon-rich and very, very dark. It's a carbonaceous asteroid. But what's interesting is now that we know that these ones are there, and that's big enough to land on, to study, NASA is saying that it could be that asteroids in this sort of position might serve even better than the Moon, because it takes less energy to get to somewhere like that, that we could set up bases there. So just to quote the spokesman, he says, they might become ideal bases for an advanced exploration of the solar system, or they could even be a source of resources. So an interesting concept. Okay, and now let's look at a new telescope that's come up with some tremendous results. This is a radio telescope. It's got a very interesting name. It's called Meerkat. So, sounds like that advert.
Yes.
Yeah. But it's M little two E's and then K-A-T. And I confess I don't know what the initials stand for. But this is in South Africa. And it's a radio telescope that comprises 64 different antennae dishes. And it's just conducted its very first commissioning observations. And the results are quite startling. It's painted an image of the centre of the Milky Way with objects and features that previous studies just haven't shown at all. And in the slides, I include a picture of one of those. You know, although it's a radio image, it gets converted into visual equivalents for publicity purposes. And this particular image shows a supernova remnant, which is the remains of when a star has blown up, and all of its material has been ejected into a shell that expands. But coming out of that is something called what they call the mouse, and this is a runaway pulsar star. A star that rotates exceedingly rapidly, giving out exceedingly high intensity radio emissions, and this can be seen clearly in the image as belting away from this supernova. So presumably it got ejected. Another feature that has come out from these studies of the centre of the Milky Way by this new radio telescope is that there have been masses of what's called radio filaments, long snaking features. A little bit mysterious, but now that we know that they're there, clearly they're going to get studied. And the picture shows one of those, perhaps the longest one, and this one is known as the snake. But what they've also shown in this is what they call the inferno that surrounds the supermassive black hole at the centre of the galaxy in a way that's never been shown before. So that's it. Those are the items that have taken my interest in terms of news over January.
Right, thank you very much for that update, John, and just can't wait to get the first results from that James Webb telescope.
Absolutely, no, you and me both.
Stars over Surrey, constellation of the month. Now, John, we've got a constellation of the month.
Indeed. And the constellation of the month is Orion. And that's probably after the Great Bear, Ursa Major. It's probably everybody's best-known constellation because it's so easy to find. Well, at this time of the year, it's so easy to find. We just go out as dusk falls, and there it is towards the south. And it's really interesting. If you look at different cultures, they have different patterns in the sky. They don't all necessarily have the same constellation shapes that we have. Ours are primarily named after Greek and Roman mythological feature characters and so on. But virtually all of the different cultures have Orion as a man, the same shape. Because of the three stars that make up the belt, the two shoulder stars, then you've got the smaller group making up the head, and then below the belt, two stars that make up the knees, and so on. And below that, below the belt is the three stars hanging down that make up the dagger, and so on. So everybody could recognise that, no matter, you know, what kind of part of the world that you come from. And it's a very interesting constellation because it's got in this dagger below the belt, it's got a star-forming region. You know, we call it the Orion Nebula, M42, Messier 42. But it's where stars are being formed now as the gas that makes up the nebula condenses under gravity. So it's a stellar nursery there. It's also an interesting constellation, and I'll mention it now if I may, because the Campaign for the Protection of Rural England, CPRE, do an annual star count, and they're asking us to help them to work out how dark our skies are around the country. And a good way of doing that is for you to go outside, look up, let your eyes become adjusted to the dark, so wait 20 minutes or so, then look at Orion. Look at the rectangle that's made up by the four stars of the two shoulders and the two knees, and count the stars inside there. So that includes the three stars of the belt and the three stars that you'd see making up the dagger. So that's a good six to start with. But how many more can you see? It excludes the stars at the corners. You don't count the shoulders and the knees. You can sign up for this. Just go to CPRE website. Sign up in advance. You can download, if you wish, a little activity pack. And you can submit your results online as well. So it just happens to fit our constellation of the month. So serendipity. So that's from the 26th of February on to the 6th, I think it is, of March. So get out there, folks, and get your results in.
The month ahead for Stars Over Surrey. So, what are we going to be able to look at in the night sky over the next month, John?
Okay, well, we've still got some of our favourite autumn constellations around, like Taurus, with the Pleiades cluster nicely positioned, and then our constellation of the month in the south and southwest, Betelgeuse, depending on your time of night. But you can use the belt stars to point down to the left toward the brightest star in the sky, and that's Sirius, and that's in the constellation of Canis Major, or the big dog. There's also a little dog as well with the bright star Procyon as well. That's not too far from Betelgeuse as well, which is the main star of Orion. But then we've got Gemini not far away from Orion. Moving further over to the southeast, we've got Leo coming up, and then Virgo rising in the east. So a great set of constellations to interest us. Let me move on to the sunrise and sunset. If you're interested in looking at the moon and so on, the best time of the month to do that is around the 8th, when it's a half moon, which is what astronomers call the first quarter, because that's when the shadows are the longest and it looks more dramatic through a telescope or binoculars. So new moon is on the 1st of February, the full moon is on the 16th, so that's it's nice. It lights up the night sky, but it washes out all of the fainter objects, so it swings and roundabouts when it comes to the moon. But the sun is, of course, rising earlier and earlier now, and setting a little bit later. So we are coming out of the depths of winter. So it does mean that, as far as astronomy is concerned, slightly shorter nights. But so get out there and get observing if you can. Now, in terms of the planets, Mercury is probably best seen in this first week of the month. It's a morning object, so in the southeast. But it is fairly low, so you do need a good clear horizon to be able to find that. But Venus will be a little bit higher than Mercury, also a morning object in the southeast. That one rises a couple of hours before the sun. And if you do have a small telescope, even a bird spotting scope, that sort of thing, and turn it onto Venus in the morning, you should be able to see it and get it focused properly as a crescent. Mars, the next planet out, is again a morning object, so low again in the southeast, but that's not so easy to find at the start of the month, much better towards the end of the month. It'll be rising by then about an hour and a half before the sun, so it gives it a chance to creep out of the morning twilight and be seen against the darker skies. Jupiter, it's our last chance, really, to see Jupiter for the first half of this month. Still as an evening object, still very, very bright at magnitude minus 1.9, but the increasing evening twilight will do for it by month end. Saturn has gone. That's pretty well already swallowed by the twilight. Although not seen by the naked eye, you need binoculars or better still a telescope. Uranus is actually still the best placed of all of the planets because it's nice and high, about 50 degrees high in the south-southwest, pretty well all month. But we need binoculars, as I say, to find it, and you do need to have a star map, because otherwise, to be able to work out which one it is, because otherwise it'll just look like an ordinary faint star. Same for Neptune, still an evening object in the west-southwest, but even fainter than Uranus, and so definitely needs a telescope. And that goes into the twilight by month end, so it's your last chance. Only a few things to tell you about in terms of astronomical phenomena. On the 8th, we get this light and shadow, clair-obscure effect, called the lunar X and the lunar V, which appear on the moon's terminator on the 8th. And they first appear at about at 6 o'clock, just a little bit before 6 o'clock. All they are is the lunar X is two adjoining craters, so it's one wall of the crater and the outside wall of the adjoining crater get lit by the sun at the same time, and so give this sort of slightly curved X shape. And it's much the same for the lunar V a little bit further up. So the terminator is that day-night dividing line on the moon. On the 18th, Venus and Mars make a nice pair about 6 degrees apart in the morning, about an hour before sunrise. And on the 27th, Venus and Mars again, but they're joined by the crescent moon. So that will make quite a nice sight again. Meetings at local societies aren't too many to tell you about because so many of them are still doing it on Zoom. But on the 11th of February, Yule Astronomical Society, which meet at Nonsuch High School for Girls in Cheam, have Professor Peter Bull from the University of York, and his subject is A Window Through the Universe. Croydon Astronomical Society are also gone back to physical meetings, but their website as yet don't show any title or speaker for tonight's meeting on the 4th of February or the Friday the 18th either, but keep an eye on their website if you live in that area and fancy going along. They meet at Trinity School in Croydon in the Sanderson Room. Now, one society that I don't think I've mentioned before, it's our most august society, the Royal Society. They've got a webinar that they're making available to all the public to join completely free. And that's Wednesday the 9th of Feb, 6:30 to 7:30, so that's on Zoom. And it's Dr. Susie Imber. She's from the Department of Physics and Astronomy at Leicester University. And she's delivering the Rosalind Franklin lecture, and it's called Space Weather and Implications for Life on Other Worlds. So 6:30 to 7:30 via Zoom. Some people who are listening might recognise her name, Susie Imber. She was the young contestant who entered that competition that was on television for So You Think You've Got It Takes to Be an Astronaut, and she won it. And that was judged by Tim Peake and others. I've heard her speak several times. She's really, really good. And fascinating, her hobby with partner is to go off and climb unclimbed mountains in the South American Andes. So,
right.
Obviously, got what it takes. But that should be a very interesting talk. She's responsible for one of the experiments on the Bepi Colombo mission to Mercury, which is currently en route there. Another talk that's online that people might find of interest, the British Interplanetary Society, and this is on also Wednesday the 9th, so it does clash a little bit, I'm afraid, with that previous one, from 7 o'clock to 8 o'clock, and that's via Crowdcast, I believe. So considering off-world living from romantic notion to harsh reality by Professor Andrew Edkins. But I'm a little bit unclear of the BIS's pricing model. It's free if you are a member of that society, and a good many of our listeners could well be. But they will, I think, charge you £10 if you're not, but offset that against your membership should you wish to join. Another one that costs you just £3 to go Space Watch, and you book via Eventbrite for that, and that's Extra Galactic Astronomy on the Wednesday the 16th of February, 7:30 to 9:30, University of Durham speaker, Dr. Anna McLeod. And I normally finish by telling everybody, Graham, about the sky at night.
Indeed, yes.
But they're taking a break in February and March,
are
so
they?
We'll be back with us in April. So I'm afraid less for me to talk about. So that's it.
Well, it's been a pleasure being with you today, John. I'm sure Dave will be back next month. And thank you very much for your usual fascinating insights.
My pleasure.
And let's hope we get some results from that James Webb telescope soon.
Absolutely. But I'm afraid not till probably May or June.
Well, we've got to be patient.
Indeed.
Well, this show is going to be repeated on Monday night at 11 p.m. and is available after transmission as a podcast. The next edition of Stars Over Surrey will be on Friday the 4th of March. So it's goodbye from me, and it's goodbye from John.
Indeed. Goodbye, everybody.
Stars Over Surrey with Dave Jemetis and John Axtell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.